Question 116. Is it not written, my house will be called the house of prayer? Luke 19:46, Matthew 21:13, Mark 11:17, John 2:13-17. And he taught, saying unto them, Is it not written, my house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer? But ye have made it a den of thieves. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables, and said unto them that sold doves, Take these things hence. Make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, The zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. With Passover approaching, Jesus went to Jerusalem. Activity was at a yearly high, and people were milling about and preparing for Passover. The monumental task of ridding the city and suburbs of leaven was nearing an end, and on the 10th day of the month, the selection of lambs was to occur. Choosing the required sacrifice was not as difficult as was in the days before. Many of the people simply went to the temple and purchased the animal they wished to offer from a man well qualified to select and provide a proper sacrifice. Those who traveled from great distances were given special provision as well. They need not bring their offerings on the hoof the long journey. They could sell their livestock and their tithe of corn and wine, then carry the money to Jerusalem and purchase their sacrificial animals there. This had become a great business. But again, wherever the provision and kindness of the Lord meets the slothfulness and greed of man, compassion will be abused. The option of selling and repurchasing was used for gain, and the worshipful aspect was gone. Man was involved, and he was sure to make money on the deal. The buying and selling had turned the steps of the temple into a noisy, cluttered barnyard filled with tables of cages and boxes of money. There were men clamoring for the business of the stranger in town, and all claiming to have the best deal. It had become a circus. The temple's outer court was the only place this commerce could be carried out. To do business in the temple was an abomination. The Jews didn't mind doing it here because this particular court was called the Court of the Gentiles. Jesus saw the disparity and prejudice. As he approached the scene, the scripture in Isaiah 56:7 repeated in his mind, Even them will I bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people. All people. Then immediately the reference in Jeremiah 7:11, Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. With these two thoughts wrestling in his mind, and with the zeal for God's temple burning within, Jesus went and sat down with some small cords and began to tie them into knots. Surely the disciples ask, What are you doing? Where are you going? We have no way of knowing the actions, conversations, or thoughts beforehand, but time was taken to construct or purchase a weapon and plan an assault. We're now nearing the end of the life of Jesus. These, as well as other actions, will prove to be his undoing. As he approached the crucifixion, his preaching became harder toward the established religion and its leadership. On the last Sabbath day before his death, he lambasted the hypocritical Pharisees like never before. And on this day he went so far as to arm himself and perform destruction upon the merchandisers of forgiveness. What was all the concern anyway? Were not these merchandisers simply helping people do the right thing? They didn't create sacrifices. They only supplied them. It was God who commanded that the sacrifices be given, and he made provision for them to be bought and sold. What is the problem? Perhaps it was the location. Maybe it was the price. The lack of sincerity could have been a factor. If we cannot determine the problem, perhaps there's a problem with us. Selling sacrifices, marketing forgiveness, merchandising the gospel, providing at a cost the free relationship between God and his people is disgusting. Can we see Jesus going through and overturning the book tables and cassette tape racks, dumping boxes of money, unplugging credit card machines and cash registers in the foyer of our conventional churches? Can we hear him condemn the merchandising, the selling of sermons, the solicitation of offerings, and the evangelist for hire? Who's not been offended by these practices? And who's not felt the twinge of guilt, embarrassment, or had to dampen pride while being viewed by everyone when an offering plate has been passed beneath their nose? Why are all these negative sentiments ignored and the practice continued? The answer is simply this. The churches cannot continue in their present state of luxury and growth if people are not asked, compelled, coerced, embarrassed, and, for all intents, forced to give. There is one reason why we ignore the plain truth expressed in Matthew 6:1-4, to give in secret, and one reason only. We cannot build great churches that way. If the people are left to do what they're led to do, nothing will be done. Whether this is because they're not listening to God or not led to give to these merchandising churches is not known, but one suspects it's both reasons. Money is the fly in the ointment, the evil sufficient for the day, the leaven that overtakes the lump. We have become so used to paying for everything and charging for everything that we, without a qualm, invite this practice into spiritual things where it does not belong. Let's work toward removing it from our programs and events. Let's treat money as if it carried the potential to destroy everyone it touches. Because it does. What element of our society has it not touched and destroyed? What man is there among us who has not struggled under its power? Whether we have a lot of it or little, whether we use it or it uses us, few of us can say we have enough. Jesus taught that what is sufficient for today is all we can handle. Paul said, "For the love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." He goes on to say that we need to flee these things and follow after righteousness, as though the two, money and righteousness, are mutually exclusive. Foremost, it must be removed from places of worship. Jesus called those who merchandise ministry thieves. What had they stolen? Jeremiah used the term robbers. Who had they robbed? Were they not merely exchanging at prices agreed upon by sellers and buyers? Were they not selling merchandise that properly belonged to them? What had they stolen? What they had stolen was the worship, the quiet. The silent invitation had become an item for barter. The only place near the temple where Gentiles could approach was occupied with enterprise. Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come. Come ye, buy and eat. Yea, come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. The actions and events at the temple that day were profoundly offensive on many levels. God's sacrifice despised, his temple desecrated, prejudice, impiety, and insincerity to the highest level of the priesthood. Even though the law was carried out to the letter, it was the personal communion of the sacrifice that was compromised. It was sincere prayer that was now missing. And because of all this commerce, there was no room for the Gentiles. It was no longer whosoever will let him come. It had become whoever can afford, or whoever is accepted among our own kind. But is it not written, "My house shall be called of all people the house of prayer"?